culture. It's a dialogue on cliched archetypes. But there was a little essay that we had inside that I should have brought with me. I just dumped out at the last moment. So we're going to reconstruct it in about 2 seconds on one side here, Wilfred. Mm-hmm. That was one that began with definitions Well, Wilfred, we've been enjoying ourselves over this projected book on cliché to archetype, having discovered that there was a strange relationship between the two. What do you think is the best way to get at an exposition of the theme?
A cliché to archetype, Marshall?
Yeah, do you think we ought to tackle the idea of cliché first as some cluster accumulation through old usage of fresh perceptions?
I would think that would be a good idea. For example, I think one might start with a cliché like the during the 18th century, the clock cliché, the tendency to compare everything to clock.
The Newtonian universe was a clock.
The mind is a clock. The human baby ticks, et cetera, et cetera.
Everything became measurable by my moments, isolated moments in time.
Exactly.
Points of view were isolated moments.
It was always the machine that was being used for simile, for comparison, for analogy. And in, as I see it, what happens, and you can correct me, as I see it, what happens is that this suppresses all the other media, all the other...
Possible ways of measuring time?
All the other possible ways of perceiving, of perception.
Experiencing time.
Time and place.
The clock image is a highly visual one, isn't it? Highly specialized and really leaves out the experience of time.
Exactly.
The moment you experience time, you're in the existential world, the instantaneous, the all-at-once, the total involvement.
Exactly.
So you could say that everything we call existence comes in with a rush, with electricity and the all-at-onceness, in which instead of a specialized position, a specialized approach to anything, you're suddenly flooded with a multi-sensuous awareness. Well, I suppose that's one way of getting back to the archetypal versus the cliché. If cliché is a collection of perceptions packaged and congealed by usage, then when you bump one cliché into another, there tends to be a kind of breaking of the carapace, the wrapping, and the clichés gush forth in a world of suggestions and new perceptions. The kind of thing that happens when you take two banal old plots or old melodies and rub them together.
Exactly.
And get a whole world of new music and new dramatic insight.
Is this what, Shakespeare does with a double plot?
Yeah, both his plots are usually commonplace, old, familiar things, which he proceeds to smash together or bang together and really get some completely new awareness out of them.
Well, say, wouldn't this happen in parody when you have a parody of some...
Any parody would tend to take one form and bang it into another form, like a Gilbert and Sullivan takeoff on an opera,
mm-hmm.
a grand opera, or a thing like the Dunciad, in which you glorify the world of stupidity and dunces in order to explain, really, the character of printing.
Exactly. And this would happen very often in theater of the absurd, wouldn't it?
You do an imitation of imitations.
Exactly. What is strange about this, as to my mind, is that although it's really very intellectual and very very arid in some ways, it has a great deal of power. And how do you explain this power?
Well, we could go back to the techniques used by Joyce in Finnegan's Wake, when he takes typically cliches like, though he might have been more humble, there's no police like Ohms, where he takes the old cliches about, be it ever so humble, there's no place like home, and then reveals by punning on Holmes, H-O-L-M-E-S, and H-O-M-E-S, and O-H-M-S, punning to reveal that, after all, home is the most rigid police force in the world. It is the most rigorous disciplinary prison. And also, Holmes, the great sleuth, is suddenly revealed as a cop, a conventional sort of man of uniform, conventional violence, exerting pressure on innocent victims. But the puns on OHMS reveal another whole batch of suggestions, open up a whole range of perceptions, suggesting the world of bugging, electric bugging of environments.
Would you just a minute remind me what OHMS is?
And it's an electric unit, but it's also on His Majesty's service.
It's resistance, isn't it? A unit of resistance?
It may well be. But by banging these old cliches together, Joyce typically gets these strange releases of archetypes and fresh perception. I think we were agreed that an archetype is a fresh perception, therefore of new form, new energy in new patterns, and therefore it's something that tends to pop up in the presence of new technologies that create new environments.
Mm-hmm.
And when a new environment goes around a culture, the effect...
Yes. Yes. Okay, just a second.
Okay. Is to elicit completely new sensory responses, new forms of perception, as with the present time, with TV, the new sensory life of our time, more involved, more tactile. Well, in the same way, when the alphabet was new in the 5th century Athens, the sudden new perception of visual space became a cliché. An environment, I suppose you could say, is a kind of cliché, you know, unrecognized, not specially noted. Clichés, I suppose, in general, we could say, are things we forget about, don't notice too much.
Would I be right in thinking, following your line of thought about the cliché and archetype, that the cliché is a insistent, repeated note, fragment, a repeated...
A kind of music, a kind
exactly.
of background
or even,
noise.
Or even just a single repeated note. And then the archetype is rather like a scale, has a scale, a range. You speak of it having many dimensions.
It's new patterns of new energy tending to arise, I think, from new technologies, but also from the artistic confronting of new technologies, which result in new forms and... new ways of tackling the problems of perception in new environments.
Well, Marshall, you mentioned Joyce, and it seems to me that people who are Joyce experts are always saying that every reader gets something different out of Joyce. Would this be true of the archetypal experience?
I think so, that the individuals have unique sensory biases and preferences, And when they're really living alertly and keenly, they're likely to have completely unique responses to situations that they share at the same time with other people. Isn't it a familiar experience that if you ask anybody to compare or contrast the same experience he has shared with you, that you get a totally different story?
Exactly.
Everybody has a completely different account to give of exactly the same experience that he has shared with somebody else or with many others. That, of course, then tends to reduce itself to a common denominator by repetition, which becomes the cliché.
Yes.
By attrition, it gradually becomes cliché, but at the same time, there gets this accumulation. Within the cliché, there's an accumulation of archetypal, fresh perception, which can be released by artistic encounter and contrivance. Well, dreams, as a way of encountering the images of the day by scrubbing and repeating and purging, are a pet area of archetypal study in our time. Joyce, of course, makes them central to the wake. The wake is an all-night newsery reel, a repeat of daytime images. It's the sort of 1001 nights of Scheherazade, all in a single night. The title Finnegan, meaning tribal, and wake, meaning conscious, alert, civilized. The conflict there is itself a sort of cliche archetype one. But in dreams, we'd make encounter with all the old archetypes of all the old cultures that ever were.
Yes. It seems to me earlier we were talking about this cliche to archetype as involving one environment within another. And I asked you about a cartoon I think I saw in the New Yorker of a medieval castle and defenders pouring hot lead, heated molten lead on the defenders, on the attackers, and with the caption, heat and pour, and you were analyzing it into its components, is that right?
Yeah, the heating up of images seems to be a common human impulse. There's always the desire to amplify, enlarge, and hot up experience, with the result that it tends to reverse. The reversal of the overheated image is something that has happened with the miniskirt and many other things in our time.
You're rather suggesting that there's no more sex, eh?
The short skirt at the knee was thought to be real hot after centuries of floor-length dresses. But when the skirt assumes the old tribal little wrapping around the hips, as it were, it loses all the hot stuff and becomes a non-sex form of corporate rather than private, cool rather than hot, and a sort of non-sex. Well, by pushing, by hotting up sex, especially specialized sex, it goes very cool and non-sex and tribal. After all, tribal people are not very excited about sex and never dream of separating it away from all the other aspects of living.
Is this the way that you lead to the new morality?
I think so, and the new marriage. By the way, isn't it said that John Donne was the first person to use the word sex in our modern sense of something separate?
I think so.
Separate kind of experience?
I would rather suggest that sometime around John Donne's time, love just was phased out, the sex came in.
They began to, at that period, try to establish, this was after all the highly visual period when the visual perspective came in,
mm-hmm.
when they tried to separate experiences and concentrate on one thing at a time, one emotion at a time, one point of view at a time, one phase of space at a time, the breaking up of space and time into fragments, and is typical of the Renaissance specialism, which we call civilization, the birth of civilization, whereas the old Middle Ages had been tribal, corporate, cool.
Would you say that love was really a very emotional experience, as contrasted with sex, which was much more a sensational experience? Would that be fair?
Love is, something pervasive and extended over a long period of time, as compared with the poor benefit of a bewildering moment.
Mm-hmm.
Is a Webster or Middleton.
Mm-hmm.
The instantaneous and fragmented aspect of sex, as compared with the pervasive and extended character of love. Well, today they talk about love as a kind of no longer private or individual thing, but the love in is thought of as sort of getting into a great big bathtub and weeping Alice in Wonderland tears of metamorphic non-selfhood.
Well, surely today love goes with hatred of war and all sorts of social responsibilities.
Yes, but also the violence has been the great means of establishing private identity over so many centuries. So to abandon violence is, in a sense, to return to tribal corporate identity.
And non-sex.
Non-sex and non-private identity.
Mm-hmm.
This would be to abandon many an old cliche of space and time in favor of a new sort of tribal archetype. That might be a good place to pause, Tony, to rally our resources here.
Okay?
Mm-hmm. One way of tackling the theme of cliché archetype would be just with such familiar titles as Culture and Anarchy by Matthew Arnold, where he contrasts a civilized and sort of literary order, legalistic order, with the barbaric anarchy of the tribal and the auditory culture of the old pre-literate sort of world. Eric Havelock, in his book Preface to Plato, really does a study of why Plato was so opposed to poets. He points out that the poets in Plato's day meant the educational establishment represented by Homer, the Pete Seegers, the country music, the real educators of youth, non-literate. Once more, we return to the tribal world and tribal education in our time in the TV age. But in the 19th century, culture looked very literary, and anarchy looked very much like a barbaric ritual.
And this is coming in with people like Lear and
Edward
Lewis
Lear.
Carroll.
The whole nursery world as even the Teddy Bear's picnic sort of thing. The Bad Child's Book of Beasts, the Book of Nonsense, the Alice in Wonderland, the Through the Looking Glass, getting rid of all civilization, into plunging into a world of archetypes and metamorphoses.
Would you think that nonsense is really non-cliché?
The world of nonsense is really a banging of clichés together and a releasing of archetypes, isn't it?
Yes.
There was an old man of Cromer who stood on one leg to read Homer. The situations are absolutely crazy, but they seem to yield some very strange insight. But of course, Lewis Carroll was the great master of this, and his reeling and writhing and rhythmic, was able to break through all sorts of civilized cliches and barriers, visual barriers. A straight plunge back into the world of Peter Pan and non-Euclidean space. I suppose culture then really is visual space, and anarchy is simply auditory, acoustic space, the world of song.
The world of the tribe.
One wild anomaly is Sing Sing as the hardware area of enclosed, rigid space. Sing Sing as a prison is absolutely the craziest misnomer in all human history. It should be an area of absolute freedom of acoustic space, but it has become attached to the visual prison. I often mused at John Cage's name, since musical bars, in his case, do not a prison make. They make John Cage. They make his new world of a sort of electric circus.
Well, where is the cliche and where is the archetype in the prison space in Sing Sing?
The rearview mirror of hardware in the prison itself as organized control, as fragmented, cell-like, classified, legalistic punishment. Mm-hmm. This is civilization. This is legalism, as compared with the barbaric anarchy.
What about the social service worker who tries to turn the prison into a, you know, a re-education? Is this cliche too?
Well, they mostly, the attempts to improve or the disadvantaged is an attempt to impose some ancient hardware form on people who are reveling in the freedom of software. Slum clearance is surely one of the harshest forms of violence ever exerted against man, in which people with free, multi-sensuous lives are plunged into visual spaces of the most hygienic and specialized kind, where they, of course, suffer the pangs of hell. Mm-hmm. Slum clearance as a form of violence, torment exerted against innocent people is an amazing area. Mm-hmm. What about the Opies and their study of the lore and language of school children?
Well, the Opies claim that the child still belongs, the preschool child still belongs to the world of the tribe, that the child...
But the world of songs and dances and puns and jokes in the grade school schoolyard have never changed for... hundreds of years.
Yes, like, look at the legs on that thing, what thing, that thing, etc.
The jokes, the songs, the dances of school children in Australia, in Liverpool, in Belfast, the same.
There, and this is because they all belong to the acoustic world?
The oral tradition, which is a sort of an all-at-once, simultaneous world. It never has to be taught.
And then when they start school, then they're having cliché imposed upon them, is that right?
Well, you have visual clichés of the of visual order and syntax and classification imposed upon a world of auditory.
What if they go to a Montessori method school?
I think it's very confusing. However, to the TV child, the Montessori must look rather like baby stuff. They've gone so much further than Montessori ever thought of going. We live in two kinds of worlds, don't we? The old hardware world of services created by railways and highways and presses and books and newspapers and magazines, suddenly confronted with a new software world of electric information, a kind of imagery that is available for free to everybody in Nigeria, or Florida, or India at the same time. The new software environment is sort of tribal communism, isn't it?
I would think so. Hardware, software, could you explain those some more?
Hardware would tend to be the mechanical world of the 19th century industry. Software, the 20th century electric world, creating a sort of return to the most primitive and primal archetypes. whereas the old hardware world kept everything rigidly classified as in a dictionary or as in an encyclopedia. The clash between those two worlds would seem to be the sort of anarchy that we're plunging into at the present time. The kind of Sputnik world in which you put a new environment around the planet turns the planet itself into a hunk of camp or an old nose cone, a museum, in which all the artifacts that ever were become the exhibits in movies, National Geographic's, archaeological shows, where the whole planet itself becomes a museum piece.
And then I suppose this means what you're really saying is that in a software world, people who live in this world are terribly confused and are trying to find themselves and protest against university administrations and
bureaucracies look rather dim, yes, and unacceptable to people living in the Peter Pan world of complete anarchic freedom. The kids in Watts, California, said, "Why should we go to school and interrupt our education?" If you live in an environment of electric information that is itself a colossal teaching machine, you're somewhat like the Eskimo who deals with the entire external environment as a teaching machine.
And the software, then, is information.
And the artifacts of that world become archetypes.
Mm-hmm.
They're no longer the old classified cliches of the hardware world. The interface, the encounter, the banging together in an electric all-at-once world of all the archetypes or all the artifacts that ever were sort of breaks all the artifacts down into new archetypes, I think.
Is it, would our situation be rather like if suddenly they took out the center lines in all the streets and allowed the traffic to go where it wanted to go? Is this the archetypal world?
Except that they'd also take out the streets with the airplane. The streets disappear too.
Mm-hmm. You have the control tower, so...
The driving on the right-hand side was initiated by Napoleon for the speeding of his armed forces.
That's interesting.
And where he did not go, right-hand side driving did not go. As in England, Sweden, Austria. But he managed to get to Russia, and they still drive on the right-hand side. In the case of Vico, you have a man who... pointed out that in the ancient world, every new technology, every new environment was called a god. And the pagan gods were all technologies. And these gods were so potent that they could only be confronted in the shield of art, a la Perseus. That if you wanted to confront these new powers, these emperors' new clothes, these new vast new environments, you had to put on the shield of art and encounter them indirectly through art, that you individually could not encounter them. You weren't strong enough. This brings up, though, the role of the artist as hero, as a kind of rebel. So that in one sense, any genius has to be a rebel, and any rebel tends to be a genius. Genius being one who lives in a world of archetypes rather than of cliches.
But one question I'd want to ask at this point would be about the gods, and would the attributes of the gods, like Jupiter and the hammer, and
there's Orpheus, song
with the lyre, yes.
There's the python, the
These would be the technologies you mean.
Yeah.
And Hera with her midwives.
Now, each of these gods and goddesses were frightfully jealous of the others, and if anybody attempted to fall in love with any one of those gods or technologies, he was hated by all the others.
But when they knew, when today we say that, talk about the death of God, Does this suggest the ending of the technology?
Of the 18th century clock?
Technology. Mm-hmm.
The great God who wound up the universe and kept everything on time had disappeared with the visual culture of electricity. So he's dead, yes.
May I interrupt one second? The emperor isn't clothed. I thought about it. It seems to me that the frightening thing is not that everybody pretended to see the emperor's clothes, but that the adults indeed saw the emperor's clothes.
We're unwilling to admit it. This raises a good question,
well,
Herman.
They see what they're supposed to see, what their culture has brought to see.
All right. This is the way to handle this one, Herman. It's all beautifully enclosed in the little nursery rhyme about pussycat, where have you been? I've been to London to see the Queen. Pussycat, what did you there? I frightened a little mouse under the chair. This indicates that people see exactly as much of the world as their own being permits them to see. And that little people see little things, and the emperor's new clothes are rather vast environmental things like courts, queens, state, and so on. And when little puttycats go to look at the emperor's new clothes, they don't tend to see anything but the little loose threads and the little buttons and the little mice out of the chair. But the Peter Pan, the little integral lad who has never whose energies and perceptions have never been channeled by any education at all, the naughty little boy, the rebel, he sees him. He says he ain't got nothing on. By the way, there's a curious example of the emperor's new clothes in FDR. FDR, when he stood on his feet, was a leader. When he sat in a wheelchair as a cripple, he was an emperor. When he sat down, he was able to put on the whole audience and to create totally new environments. When he stood up, he merely was a specialist, fragmented leader. An emperor is a man who creates totally new worlds, new environments. These are invisible because people are too small to cope with them. Any environment, any new clothes, far too big for the ordinary person's comprehension. Therefore, they're knockout drops. Archetypes are only visible in that sense. The new clothing of an environment are only visible to artists who have a hell of a lot of punch and courage and scope. Pound used to say the artist is the antennae of the race. He picks up all the messages that other people just can't get. But most people would prefer not to get the message. They would prefer somnambulism, though it's safer. A highly motivated somnambulism is a much safer state than a wide awake, alert, a hunter, feet forward, probing. There's too much responsibility in wakefulness. Somnambulist is a much more acceptable Joe.
I think it is that education is a process of teaching people to be unaware.
It is itself the result of huge technologies like books and environments of services without which it couldn't take place. In a non-technological environment, you have the hunter. And I think Electric Man is returning to that condition. Survival now requires once more the perceptions of the hunter rather than the specialist training of the job holder. The kids know this. They won't accept school anymore as serious education because by the time you've prepared yourself for any job in the modern world, the preparation is obsolete.
Yeah,
the job is gone.
What I think you're trying to say is that the only preparation you can have now in form of schooling and training is that all you can be yourself. And in a tribal society, everybody is himself and everybody makes his own space.
In a tribal society, everybody enters the corporate dream and there is no such thing as a private identity. Nobody would dream of trying to assume a private grimace or expression. In a tribal society, people wear a mask. They do not have private faces. And this is true in Japan. It is true in Nigeria, it is true in any country where you live in an oral culture. It is now true of the TV generation. They have abandoned all private image of themselves, all private identity in favor of a corporate mask. And that's why when they're sent to schools where they're expected to be private, separate individuals, they rebel. They know that the society has gone tribal, and they know that the education is still old hat, visual and individual. They won't buy it. Esalen Institute, our Big Sur, and all those places are places where you submerge all private identity in a kind of great bath of tribal tears.
Except that only in corporate society can you be an individual. And the United States, as opposed to 20 years ago, is where conformity reigned.
Fragmentation creates conformity, and competition creates sameness. The more competitive people are, the more they resemble each other.
Right.
However, in a tribal society, it is not a question of competition. It's not a question of competition, but of sharing a corporate consciousness. Finnegan, Finn again, the Finn cycle. For example, the word Vok means cloud, and a tribe has always been called the people of the dream, living in a common dream world, never in a private, wide-awake world. The word Volk, or folk, German word for folk, is the word for cloud. And the people of the tribe enter a cloud which they share. It's like any national dream world. In Japan, the word for nation is prison. And they both have the same symbol, a little rectangular square. So a cliché is a prison, but it can be loaded with archetypes, ancient images of fresh perception. But tribal man lives the most limited and restricted life imaginable. The range of his perceptions socially and personally are extremely ritualistic, and he would never dream of having any private life. If he dreams, in tribes, each person has to confess his dreams at regular intervals. They have sessions in which all dreams are told so that they can be sure that there is no stepping over boundaries into other tribal territories.
To a certain extent, freedom has only meaning with boundaries. Without boundaries, there is no freedom whatsoever.
Well, we know what you mean. But the tribal boundaries are acoustic, not visual. And they are deeply involving, whereas visual boundaries are very detached and impersonal. The law in a Western society is extremely non-involving, detached, impersonal. In tribal society, it is totally personal and involving and corporate. There's no private law.
Yes, sir.
Nobody is ever punished in a tribal society. They simply say how horrible to feel that way.
Yeah, in a tribal society, you don't have unemployment and you don't have people who don't belong.
Oh, well, now this moment, unemployment is... That's something that belongs only to hardware societies.
Right.
But we've had an awful lot, 2,500 years of hardware, so we're talking about quite a stretch of time. The electric world is ending 2,500 years of hardware, not 500.
Mm-hmm.
It's the whole Greco-Roman tradition that it's ending. But here is another way to approach it. There's a saying, help beautify junkyards. Throw something lovely away today. The idea that the whole world is a kind of junkyard, needing tidying up by artists and civilized people, is one that amuses natives in countries like the Balinese, where they say, we have no art, we do everything as well as possible. They don't think of art as something you put in an environment, but of the environment as something you manipulate as a work of art. And art is to them magical. Now, this is where Madison Avenue has returned to the most primitive conditions of the caveman. In creating images for the magical control of the impulses and energies of publics, it does not expect people to pay any attention to the images it makes. It expects the image to exert magical power quite regardless of any attention shown to it. The cave artists did not paint their drawings or make their paintings for public viewing or private viewing. They were meant to exert power on the animal life of the outside world. Madison Avenue has returned to that condition, a voodoo art of image making to exert magical control over distant objects. This is archetypal. This is a direct return to the world of magic and remote control, ESP style. Totally uncivilized, totally non-visual, and non-rational, and capable of creating totally new world environments of cave art style. The forms used in modern advertising are those of cave art. They are iconic. There's a wonderful picture called Rosemary's Baby. What's it an ad for? It shows a baby carriage parked on top of a human profile that looks like a mountain, a sleeping giant, which in turn is parked beside a huge mountain. The cliches of mountains as sleeping giants are corporate beings. It bangs into the cliche of the human countenance, enlarged by film, enlarged by photography, into a massive corporate thing. And on top of this, you have the little archetypal image of the baby carriage and the infant. The banging together of these cliches releases a world of archetypal suggestion and audience involvement that is better than any of the art that is being shown in any of the museums of the contemporary world. The best art of the 20th century is not in the museums, but is on the advertising billboard, and in the newspapers and in the magazines.
And on TV.
And on TV. Far better than any of the programming on movie, TV, or magazine, or the ads in those magazines and in those programs. This is itself a theater of the absurd.
Mm-hmm.
The whole of modern advertising has become a theater of the absurd. It bald sopranos, imitations of imitations, yet magical in their power, full of metaphysical shudders. Noah's archetypes went two by two, thud and blunder, plot and subplot, male and female. Someone once asked, why was Cleopatra not in Noah's Ark? And someone said she was not one of his archetypes. I think we'll quit there.
I think so.
Same thing would apply to Elizabeth Taylor, I
presume. Why? She wasn't one of his archetypes? Well, she doesn't quite have the status of Cleopatra, or even of Mona Lisa. In fact, she's a rather ancient stage property, a real hunk of camp, isn't she? My gosh, Elizabeth Taylor is a long time ago. Wow, man, you got a memory. Liz Taylor is a real old history. When was she last in a movie?
It was a long time ago.
Yeah.
Last year?
No. They have Jack Dempsey advertising cat food now. Is that camp? They got all sorts of famous characters from the 20s now advertising things like cat food and Cordell. And asswipe. Howard Gossage divides all mankind into folders and crumplers. You know, apropos of Scotty tissue. Which is archetypal, which is cliche. Well, the answer is simple. The folder is cliche. The crumpler is archetype.
What's your definition of art?
Archetype is fresh perception of new energy and new form. New forms of energy. Unexpected. Startling. Helix culpa. To use your phrase.
How would your definition sort of contrast with Jung's?
Jung, I once saw Jung being interviewed on film by Dick Evans, And he was asked the same question, what is an archetype? He said it's an angel, an angelic intruder into this universe, which is about as pathetic as anything I've said tonight or any other time in my life. He knew nothing about archetypes. But he thought of them as categories, classifications, verbal, visual.
Now, when you talk about verbal and visual, I've thought about what you said about reading 60,000 words a minute.
Not, no, 60.
30.
30 is easy.
Fast reading. And
yields only, archetypes.
But only fast reading, very fast reading, is visual.
Oh, no. He's totally non-visual. At slow speeds, you're in the visual world of continuum.
At slow speed, you're in the...
continuum.
You read with the eyes, but you see it through the ears.
Now, just a moment. I know about this field properly.
Yes.
The continuum is visual. It is the only sense we have that is a continuum. The ear is not a continuum. Touch, every moment, is different. Totally discontinuous. Smell is not a continuum. Physical kinesis is not a continuum. Only sight provides a continuum. Rational connected space is visual and only visual, and exists only in highly literate societies of the phonetic kind. The Chinese have no such space, have no civilization, have no rationality whatever. They live magically in the world of the leaf, of the symbol, of the intuition, of the archetype, of the interval. Dactility is the world of the interval.
You're getting back now to a world of intuition,
Well, intuition merely means seeing into.
Intuition is visual.
No. Seeing into is ESP.
But seeing.
Or we use seeing metaphorically there to our awareness, that's all. Just awareness, sudden awareness. Touch gives sudden awareness. To the blind, all things are sudden. Every moment is new, flash, bang.
But if it's only language, the vision is the only thing where you have no time element. You analyze.
This is not true.
And you synthesize at
true.
Exactly the same time.
No, no. Vision gives you the only world of clock that exists anywhere in the world. It's only in visual time that you can have seconds or hours. And those are not experiential forms. They are visual forms, analytic and fragmented. Visual time is the most artificial, abstract form of time possible or conceivable. The Chinese measure time by smell. Have you not read my chapter on the scent of time?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Well, they don't measure it by the eye. Now, we're the only people in the world who ever measured time by the eye. The Greeks' water clocks never measured it by the eye.
What I'm trying to say is that while you measure by the eye, it is nevertheless an oral way to measure time because...
Well, look, hey, Herman, what in hell are we doing here tonight? I'm not having a discussion with you.
Oh. I'm still taping.
No. No, we've got to get home. No, and if you know, I'm never interested in arguing on any subject. I'm only interested in making discoveries. And so what, you're going over old ground that I've written on thoroughly, and you haven't read it, in Gutenberg Galaxy. Visual space is the only space that is civilized or continuous.
Uh-huh.
Now, most people don't know they live in visual space in the Western world. There is no visual space in Nigeria or in the Arab world. No Arab ever experienced visual space. He lives only in olfactory, tactile space, in auditory space. So to expect him to accept any of our thoughts.
At the end of that part?
Sure, it's a dialogue on a cliché to archetype.
Okay, stop it.
There was a little...
All participants are now unmuted.
Yeah, I looked it up. June 12, 1968 is the poster for Rosemary's Baby. I think that's what they were talking about. So this would be the summer of 68 when this is happening. He has just finished his year at Fordham, and he's going back to Toronto to take over the Center for Culture and Technology coach house, which was just provided for him while he was away. So a new phase in McLuhan's life. But that was pretty phenomenal discussion. Anybody have anything to add to that?
It was funny.
Yeah.
No, there's really a lot in that. It's really, we have to really listen, to really discuss.
Yeah, no, he's got stuff from his books in there, you know. It's like a collage of his books, plural. Yeah, it's so rich. I was thinking that he's like going to be the modern Homer. You know, the Homer was the encyclopedia of the day in Greece. He's a Homer of the 20th century. He covers so many different things, presented in different media, including the vocal means, and in casual conversation. I mean, do you have any, there's no recordings of people, professors or something, having casual conversations, making discoveries. There's panels, but they're all artificial and competitive. So these are phenomenal recordings. We're breaking new ground here.
Yeah. I'm not interested in having an argument. I'm interested in making a discovery.
And then that guy said, "I'm not arguing," which was said in petulance. And McLuhan said, "Well, you don't know the language. You haven't read my book. I've laid it all out, these terms. We're using. I'm not having a conversation with you. I'm talking technically with Wilfred Watson. It's a program conversation. It's a program conversation. They take terms and they impose it on the world, miming what the tetrad managers do. So somebody said something there?
Did he say that the Chinese don't have visual space?
Right. They don't have any civilization. They live discontinuous, not linear. That's why their religion's different. Zen Buddhism is a very non-linear religion. It's the world of the interval, the gap, the sudden insight.
The visual is the only thing that's continuous.
Well, who's saying because? Because, who's that?
Madeline.
Oh, Madeline. Have you been listening to all this?
For the last little over a half hour.
Well, that's good. Got a good dose. What do you think?
So, yeah, because the visual is the only sense that's continuous.
Connected and sequential. Yeah.
So that's linear. And I thought it was really interesting to consider advertising as the same kind of art as cave painting, where it magically affects the game.
The environment. Prey. Yeah, the environment. It's out to mold the animals, and the modern animals are the media. He says that at the end of one of his books.
Modern animals were the people who would buy the product that advertising is selling.
They're the media. They're microorganisms. The terms animals and microorganisms. So you have animals was what animals we know as, and then microorganisms are tiny little things. He says the media become the new animals and humans become microorganisms because they're so small compared to the huge environmental media forces.
So advertising affects the media.
Yes. The new animals.
Would you explain the Easter gate? You also say there are new animals there, like the dragons.
Right.
There's
a song. Yeah, I use that.
Also make us aware of new forms of life.
yeah. And in the Bosmic Ecology, the first album, one of the song titles is New Animals Waving Goodbye.
So, Bob, I'm trying to conceptualize that. Is that in the sense of corporate sponsorship? How is advertising affecting media?
Well, first of all, the rationale for advertising 100 years ago was it provided a coherent image of the directions of what the new environments were doing. It was a way of organizing a collective consensus about what the society was about. It was like talking to itself, saying, well, this is why we're doing this, so we can have these products and these wonderful new improvements. and it was a benign function. Advertising was there to inform people, like education, about what was new. But, of course, a bunch of other factors, like the electric speed-up, made advertising into a shark, a junkie version of Walter Cronkite, telling you what that's the way it is. This is the way it's going to be. So it gets complicated. You may not even understand my explanations. You have to read McLuhan. You cannot understand what he's saying unless you read the books and see where he gathers together the, quote, facts to show a proper iconic layout of an idea. So you can't get it through just talking and me explaining a couple of things. You got to experience the books.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, I guess whatever. I thought that made sense, so I must be wrong.
No, it is. You're wrong about everything when you deal with McLuhan, because he flips everything satirically. He makes everything backwards. He makes hot. Did you hear him discuss sex? Right when everybody thought there was a sex revolution, everybody's getting horny and fucking all over the place. He's saying, well, sex is dead. You know, why is he saying that? You have to find out why he's saying sex is dead right when society thought that sex had come potent. You know, he's going to, he can back up the fact that he reverses everything. That's what's the act of genius. It's a modern form of poetry. Poetry always disrupts verbal meaning. Well, he disrupts whole landscapes of meaning.
Well, did he say sex was dead because it was obsolesced by something else?
It was obsolesced by the new tribal, deadpan, impersonal, no private identity person. Sex and love come in with the printing press and private identity. Courtly love anticipated it. But the idea of having an emotional bond with one person, you have to have a person. You have to have two people. You don't have people as individual strong identities in a corporate tribal society. You ever look at a Japanese movie, the old ones, where they just all move like in unison? I mean, that's partly the West pointing that out. But also in the movies of American Indians, you have this tribal deadpan look. That's what McLuhan saw the TV generation was adopting. So I want to get on the next part. I just want to say what is amazing on this tape is you get to hear him talk about Carl Jung. He critiques Carl Jung. He critiques Carl Jung. A little bit in his books, Cliche Archetype, but nothing like he just did. He had a story. I didn't know that Jung thought the archangel was angels. It may not even be true, but McLuhan uses that and then says this guy who popularized the term archetype knew nothing about the archetype.
Yeah.
McLuhan is like Ion. He says nobody knows what they're talking about. Einstein didn't know. So-and-so didn't know. You know, it's a colossal arrogance, but it leads to a very interesting art form of ideas and patterns that are unusual.
Joyce also put down Jung and Freud.
Yeah, McLuhan did too.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a unique, he may have said it here and there in his classroom, but to get it on recording, it's not in his books. So we get it. We hear him say it. Imagine a Jungian hearing that; they'd be so pissed off.
Cool. I know. Just look how many people that are around studying that, and
yeah,
there's McLuhan to study, and how much more rich it is.
That's right, way richer, and even richer now because we understand it better because we've gone through the changes that he predicted.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's finish the last 15 minutes so we can finish the show at 5, my time, 5 in the morning. Okay, so thanks for your contributions. Hope you're around when we finish. More gems will come forth in the next 15 minutes. You can guarantee to that.
All participants are now muted.
Okay, so here we go. Volume's up. Just a minute.
explaining how it changes your sense of color and taste. I'm sorry, how color changes your sense of taste and smell. Smell is electric, he says. It's an entirely electric sense. And instant and electric. Total, not fragmented. But it's a fascinating book and full of funny things.
I told me this recording I got of this young girl the other day where she says she wants to play her life by ear.
Flying by the seat of the pants?
Play it by ear, that's a common phrase, isn't it?
Yeah, that's cliche.
Mm-hmm.
But it does mean no goals. Now, there, the life of goals is visual. Targets, points of view, vanishing points, visual man. Finished in electric world, you can't have them. It's impossible to have a goal in an electric world where you have a total field. We're in a mosaic newspaper, we didn't even go into mosaic.
Mm.
You can, in a world of mosaic, which is all at once, simultaneous, you can't have goal. You can only have probe. Because you never know what you're going to encounter next. Every moment's different. New, surprising. It's the world of the rebel, the poet, the child, the Peter Pan. Do you think we have a chance to make our old 10 o'clock train?
No.
Well, you know, it's 10:05 or something like that. No. Well, we'll make the 10:30 one. 10:20, 25 or something. There's one every half hour or so. This man has a plane to get tomorrow early. For Edmonton, yeah.
From Canada, then
yeah. Well, it's a fairly early plane. What have you been doing, Herman, besides arguing on...
I don't argue at all.
Well, you're telling me a lot of things that I know better.
That's possible.
About space. I've got my new book is out, or rather, I've got it in hardcover on space in poetry and painting.
But
Harper and Row.
I only buy softcover books.
It'll come out in softcover. Software, hardware, all that's it. So lousy production, design wise. Harper and Row are good at that. The War and Peace book will be out August 10. Should have been out months ago. And that's on the subject of violence and goals. And image and identity. Violence as the quest for identity.
Well, that's pretty appropriate to this time.
It was more appropriate when I wrote the book about a year ago. The publishing industry is so slow. Even magazines, for cat's sake, they can't get anything out under 3 months. Their schedules don't permit anything under 3 months.
What is the relation to Negro to radio that you were speaking about?
When the radio was new, the Negro grabbed the new form and related speech to it again, dance and song, and created a form, archetypal form, that was accepted instantly in Tokyo, Berlin, every part of the world, integrated the world. Now we're talking about integrating the Negro. First, he integrated the whole damn world. Then we now try to integrate him. This is the craziest thing at all. Now the Cockneys, the London or Liverpool Cockneys, are integrating the world by Oriental strummings. Oh, we can go back to that. And the East-West integration this time, the Oriental, instead of the Negro integrated the Western world, well, the Cockneys are now integrating the East-West complex. But they're doing it by ear, strumming. And this response of a literary man to a thing like radio is he is futile. He merely says it's a degradation of all decent culture and literature, and it's the end.
I'd like to ask you a question. You hear many expressions, many times, that a gut decision. Sometimes comes, you know, really a gut decision. What, in your opinion, is the impact of a visual experience in a writing at a gut decision?
Well, gut simply means total involvement of all the senses at once. Proprioception is the whole being. And this happens in multimedia worlds. You see, the electricity puts your nervous system outside as an environment. By the way, look at the cover of June 8 TV Guide, Dali picture of what TV really is.
What's the
signal? Two thumb levels. Now, the interval between the two is the all-important thing. Touch is interval. No connection in touch. That's why in this new electric interval world, the strumming, the old return to the old tactile instruments, is so important. But he knew that those two thumbs containing two TV screens had to have a big interval between them, because interval is touch. TV is touch. On the horizon, he put a little bit of brain tissue to show that the environment of electric power is nervous, central nervous system. We now live inside our own nervous system as a world environment. So when you are surrounded by your own nervous system, the only possible response is gutsy. There isn't any other possibility.
You know,
how does that account for your expression saying, well, everybody has got, in a sense, of behaving, you know, tribally, but wearing one face?
When you're inside a single involving environment, you don't try any private expression. You put on the corporate mask, the Hopa mask, or the Iroquois mask, and you stay inside that proudly. The Negro is proud of his, under these new conditions, the Negro is proud of his mouth. It's not private.
If you put it that way, Marshall, you're saying putting on a mask, is that what you show?
It's putting on the public.
Yeah,
a mask is the public.
It's not you, and behind the mask, that's right. You can be what you are.
Just a moment. You make your image. You don't have an image. There isn't a you that you don't make. Any you that there is something you make. You contrive.
Yes, but you...
You're not given an image that is you. You are
in a mechanized society.
Well, we're not in a mechanized society and haven't been for 50 years. And in for fully 50 years, we've been outside a mechanized society. Humpty Dumpty went back together again at least 50 years ago. That doesn't mean that the bureaucrats notice. For example, did you see that bit the other day about the influx of CIA material so fast that they can't read their own mail and don't know their own secret messages anymore?
That's right. They can't handle it.
That's how they lost the Pueblo. They hadn't been able to read the mail. But what happens? This is high speed. What happens at high speed? Pattern recognition. You no longer get the message of classified data as you do at low reading speeds. You suddenly see the dance of thought. At high reading speeds, you follow the dance of thought. An author's mind begins to dance in front of you, and repetitively, because the greatest mind in the world has only one page of thoughts to offer to mankind, and he dances that thought over and over and over and over and over.
I'm happy to hear that, because I wrote a doctoral dissertation of 17 pages, and now reading the copy.
Well, remember,
it's 900 is stuff.
Remember that Einstein's life work is in one line.
E is mc squared.
And remember that poor old Karl Marx had not a clue as what was going on in his own time, let alone the future. He was pure rearview mirror. That is, like any utopian, he looked only at the past. He thought that tribal communism was the only ideal one. Now we got it. But he thought it was a return to tribal conditions. He never thought you could get it by electricity, which had already happened in his own time. He thought you could smash up the hardware world of the bourgeoisie and return to tribal communism. Romantic style, that was his dream. Now, in 1820, the service environments of hardware in England, available to the ordinary guy for a few shillings, postal systems, travel, knowledge, education, press, were far in excess of the greatest wealth. Not the richest man in the world could buy the services available to a poor man in 1820 in England. That was communism. It happened long before Marx. Hardware communism. Hardware communism happened before Marx was born. Now, he saw it as a future dream like Orwell. 1984 happened before Orwell was born. Now, software communism, which we've got, is tribal. And it's multi-billion dollar communism for free. It doesn't cost anything. The small child has it for free. The Nigerian has it for free. All the programs are free. It's a world environment, a teaching machine for free of affluent images. Now, when the native or infant wallows in this multi-billion dollar tribal communism, he says, where are the cornflakes? I've got the multi-billion dollar check in my pocket. I've got all the experience that mankind ever had, but where are the cornflakes? Where's the hardware? So they scramble around trying to have a 19th century in Nigeria or Russia. But they've already passed into the, But you see, the dilemma is that the poorest people in the world now live in a multi-billion dollar service environment. And they don't have the ordinary cheap hardware of the old 19th century.
I'd like to ask you another question. You think that most philosophies today, with the exception of existential philosophy, is pathologically addicted to the past?
No, I wouldn't say so. But I don't think of existentialism as a philosophy, it's just an experience of nowness. It's not a philosophy. It's an experience.
So, in a way, what you're saying is what most people are fighting for is something that has
already happened.
Meaning.
No, it's already happened.
Or it has already happened.
Always. That's true. You see, the so-called American defense against the rising tide of communism, communism happened way back there, and America was one of the main causes of it. It's trying to hold it back in Nigeria.
Would the artist be a possible exception?
Yes, the artist isn't taken in by this stuff, but who's he against so many?
Or the children. Education.
But you see, now the United States is destroying itself by trying to hold back a rising tide of communism that happened 100 years ago.
Fighting the windmills.
Yeah. And they don't have enough strength. There are too many windmills.
Oh, windmills. There are always too many because when you knock one over, the next one is right behind it.
You don't knock one over, they knock you over. As Don Quixote said, what a blow that phantom gave me. Wow. But, the U.S. is finished simply because it is unable to perceive the obvious. Environmental change, the emperor's new clothes, fool it just as much as they ever fooled anybody.
What I'd like to know is why in the hell doesn't it see it?
Oh, well, because it takes more powers of perception and more intensity of awareness than they've got, that's all. They're absolutely soaked up in their old hardware service environments, a la motor car, airplane stuff. Oh, the U.S. has a huge stake in the old hardware, 19th century.
This is what the speed-up causes, does it?
The old backward countries have no stake in the old 19th century hardware. They can move straight into the new communism, into the new software. Nigeria gets radio before it gets cornflakes.
Cultures are a leapfrogging kind of experience. Anyway.
Burrowing through each other. As in dreams. We go now. We must go now.
Make your number 30.